You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
This is not something that we can ignore. It's not something we can just sweep under the rug as just another disturbing footnote in a sad election season. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts.
As Donald Trump's pollsters put Michelle Obama down as undecided, has the Orange Republican nominee passed the point of no return? My guests Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli and Thomas Lewis will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including...
In my opinion, the only real alternative to a hard Brexit is no Brexit.
The EU asks the UK to pick a window, Colombia getting to grips with an electorate which won't do as it's told, and a surprise winner of a poll to decide Scotland's top man-made attraction. What other architectural marvels are we overlooking? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle's Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli joining me in the studio, and Monocle's Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis joining us from Toronto. Welcome all. Now, it has been another eventful 24 hours or so for the Orange Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. The New York City Comptroller's Office has discovered that Trump made no donations to 9/11 charities despite his statements to the contrary. He has been forced to deny ever more vociferously, ever more accusations of behaviour towards women, which could most charitably be described as creepy. The New York Times lawyers have responded to his recent threats to sue by inviting him to come and have a go if he thinks he's hard enough. And the First Lady of the United States has given a speech about him which few of us would want as our eulogy.
This is not something that we can ignore. It's not something we can just sweep under the rug as just another disturbing footnote in a sad election season. And to make matters worse, it now seems very clear that this isn't an isolated incident. It's one of countless examples of how he has treated women his whole life. And I have to tell you that I listen to all of this, and I feel it so personally. And I'm sure that many of you do too, particularly the women. The shameful comments about our bodies, the disrespect of our ambitions and intellect, the belief that you can do anything you want to a woman. It is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts.
Michelle Obama, the rest of that speech is well worth hearing in full if you have not already. Tom Edwards, she didn't mention Donald Trump by name. No one's in much doubt who she was talking about. It's a terrific piece of writing and a terrific piece of speech, a terrific piece of oratory. But that aside, does it... What I'm trying to figure out at this point, who are the undecideds where Donald Trump is concerned at this point?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, Andrew. There's still been one or two... one or two lone voices, you get what I mean, within the Republican movement, women, that is, who I think still would... you know, go with their political instincts and vote for Donald Trump simply because he's the, you know, Republican on the ballot. And that's stirring words. As you said, it's impressive from Michelle Obama. I don't know. It gets me to look further ahead. You know, we've had our sort of Bush, Clinton political dynasties developing. Is there another Obama? So states, Mike. I mean, the tone that's set there is so refreshingly sensible. It makes you sort of wish for how this campaign maybe could have gone.
There's something about 2016 worldwide that I think every time somebody in public life who comes across as a rational grown-up speaks, it's just more refreshing than it needs to be. I mean, on that subject, Daniel, I think people sort of suggesting Michelle for president are possibly getting a bit ahead of themselves
at this point.
But I was only partially joking.
But nonetheless, there are people discussing it semi-seriously. And, you know, if that were to happen, say we get 8 years of Hillary Clinton, followed by eight of Michelle Obama, then if I've done my maths right, that would have the White House traded between three families for 44 years. You guys had an entire revolution to slough off the principle of hereditary power. What is it with Americans and dynasties?
Exactly. For that reason, it'll never happen. I mean, I can't imagine we would vote in any other Bush after this, or, I mean, we've already exhausted the Bushes. Jeb did terribly. There's a few Bush youngsters in the family, 20 and 30-somethings, who have political ambitions, but to reach the top office, I mean, I just can't imagine. There's something comfortable, I guess, about having a family name that you trust, but, you know, that's what leads to dictatorships. I mean, you know, having a name, ooh, a Bush or a Clinton, you know, at least we know the name. It's not going to be some kind of, like, you know, touch wood, crazy person. But for that reason, people feel comfortable when they see a name they know. But I can't imagine Michelle Obama.
Thomas, to bring you in from Toronto, you are, of course, closer to all this than we are. Are we being a little ahead of ourselves at this point in starting to talk about the presidential election as a foregone conclusion? Are people in the United States and Canada writing him off at this point as well?
Well, it's a really difficult question, actually. I think it's sort of so amazing that, you know, the tempo of these new revelations, I guess, kind of recently over the past week and a half, 2 weeks or so, you know, are raising questions, very sensible ones, saying, well, listen, how is he ever going to sort of turn this around? Just today, though, I was watching one of the American political talk shows, and they had a sort of panel where they were sort of saying, well, look, he's sticking to this pretty aggressive strategy, sort of not really following the sort of model of, you know, political sort of convention or political niceties at all, because he wants to drive turnout down. And, you know, when you sort of, you know, talk about, say, these suspicions that people sort of mention pretty frequently about Hillary Clinton, for example, kind of these chapters in her past, kind of her professional career, and, you know, that people still don't quite know what to make of her, whether they downright sort of dislike her, you know, 100%, or just think there's something suspicious about her, you know, I think that is still quite potent. So will that mean that people just don't show up on election day? It might well do. I think, though, from, you know, just watching Hillary Clinton's responses to these, I think she's actually playing it quite well. She's done an appearance on the Ellen DeGeneres talk show, where she was talking about the second debate last Sunday and talking about Donald Trump stalking her, basically, on the stage, you know, when he was sort of looming behind her like this kind of big grisly spectre, and, you know, making kind of a bit of currency in that arena, I think, is quite clever for her. Because, you know, to go back to Michelle Obama, obviously Hillary Clinton quoted her in the second debate saying, when the Republicans go low, we go high. And that's definitely been, you know, Hillary Clinton's kind of unofficial strategy, I think, for this campaign, when so much mud has been thrown from the other side. So I think for her to try to capitalize on this kind of, you know, pretty creepy kind of persona that's, you know, to put it lightly, that's being sort of fleshed out now of Donald Trump, you know, it's kind of almost sort of keeps her, it kind of adds her to the mix, really, as one of the people who are sort of the target of his attacks, rather than being this kind of aloof figure who's sort of criticizing from afar. So, yeah, I mean, I think, just to go back to Michelle Obama's speech, I mean, I think she's become this incredibly potent kind of asset to Hillary Clinton. And I think, actually, she won't seek political office, not this stage anyway, because I think that's why people listen to her, because they feel that she's very genuine, that she's obviously a very compelling speaker, and obviously, you know, had some very interesting, thoughtful things to say about the state of the campaign, and I suppose the state of the nation more broadly. And I think it's quite an interesting use of the office of First Lady, and whether that sort of becomes sort of a template for you know, presidential spouses to come, you know, would be quite interesting to see, I think. But no, I think they're using Michelle Obama pretty effectively, and she's also using the opportunity pretty well too.
Danny, final thought on this subject, and I'm going to ask you to speak on behalf of
All 350 million
of your fellow citizens. Sure. From this point of view, what is Donald Trump's best shot? Is it to try and suddenly reinvent himself as a reasonable statesman, or just to double down on the swivel-eyed, crazy stuff?
Well, I think he's done for. I mean, I really, really think he's done for. I think there's no way the revelations that have dragged him down in the past couple days he could really get out of. But that being said, I don't think he should double down now on any kind of like elder statesman kind of rationality. I think he has to keep attacking Hillary. I mean, I'm not advising him like the prince and Machiavelli here, but I mean, I think he really has to go full on crazy if he really wants to win. He has to, but he knows he's not going to win. That's why he's trying to burn down the Republican, you know, house, as it were. He just wants to go out in a blaze of glory and create Trump TV at this point. I really think he knows it's over.
He needs to stick with his core. We know that there's a constituency there that, you know, that his approval ratings go up when these revelations come out. So he just has to keep with them and see if he can break through, I don't know, what, 40 points maybe in November?
But I mean, the interesting thing is Pence came out and said today there's going to be revelations that suggest that he didn't do all this sexual assault. You know, he was on a TV show, Pence, and he said, well, you know, I don't condone the language, but he didn't do actual sexual assault. And today there's going to be revelations that suggest and prove that he didn't do it. I haven't seen anything today yet, but they are claiming today something's going to drop.
Well, that's something to look forward to. Here in Britain, meanwhile, the country has been thanking the US presidential election campaign for sparing it the kind of quizzical pity being directed at America from elsewhere. Since Prime Minister Theresa May announced that the UK would begin its formal exit from the EU early next year, Britain has begun to understand how turbulent Brexit might actually be and how little anyone else cares. European Council President Donald Tusk this week emphasised that the UK's choices were hard Brexit or no Brexit, for which read stay put or sod off, isn't it, basically, Tom?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if the idiom is received and understood globally, but the notion of turkeys voting for Christmas, I imagine people are familiar with. And it seems like finally people in Britain are waking up to what they themselves have done in that fashion. I actually thought that Donald Tusk's comments were pretty reasonable. He had clearly been antagonised by Boris Johnson.
You know, one
of the Brexiteers in chief who had said, oh, you know, we can have our cake and eat it. And I think Tusk said quite pleasingly, not only that will there be no more cake, but there'll just be salt and vinegar.
Yes, you I propose a simple experiment, he said. Buy a cake, eat it, and see if it's still there on the plate.
But I think this is exactly right.
But Tom, what about Parliament voting for it? Because they really want to vote for it, and now they've just been told today that they can't.
But this taps in, Danny, to one of the things that Tusk was saying, which is there are still two options on the table. It's either out or it's stay. And I guess the people who are now challenging in the High Court this idea that the government can instigate this on their own without Parliament voting, they're still trying to find a legal loophole to put it back before the whole of Parliament hope that we could remain. And that ultimately, that's what might happen.
Voting on how it happens. That's really what they're most worried about. They want to vote the terms on which the negotiation happens.
I still think that's a stalking horse for trying to keep a Remain option on the table. And that, you know, I would not be entirely surprised should we be in a situation 18 months from now where it's just been too fiendishly difficult. I think the government's handling...
There's no way.
Well, it looks inept. I don't like their rhetoric. It's unsavoury. It's deeply distasteful. And it's pandering to a lowest common denominator. But the scale of the task ahead for Britain to try and extricate itself may yet prove too much. Here's hoping.
I mean, it would be quite something, I think, if Theresa May or any other prime minister just said, "You know what? We've looked into this, and it's not going to work."
But then, why would she double down so forcefully this week in PMQ saying it's going to happen?
Because she's trying to keep the Yahoo wing of her own party on side, and she's not one of them.
And there's no consequences politically for her to do that, or for the Tories more broadly. That's why they're all coming out with this lunatic invective over the last 2 weeks, because they know that even going right through till 2020. They'll probably win again with an increased majority, because let's be honest,
there's no opposition.
It's not that edifying if you look at the rest of the political landscape.
And Thomas in Toronto, you are out there in the world where Marmite is still presumably freely available. How does Britain's current self-inflicted wound look from the other side of the Atlantic?
Well, people are still scratching their heads here, frankly, as am I. And I think, you know, Tom, you sort of, and Danny, you were sort of saying about, you know, sort of Parliament voting, this kind of thing. I just cannot understand how, you know, sort of the letter of the law can be so subject to sort of the political whims of the day. Like, surely that isn't negotiable. You know, if you look at the text of Article 50, if a nation wants to withdraw, isn't it, you know, by the due process of the country in question or the constitutional norms or something, I think the text says. And it's been widely sort of, you know, agreed that the constitutional norms in the UK would be Parliament. So whether that's a vote on, like Danny said, how it happens or whether we even do it at all, I really think it's unacceptable, actually, that that's just been sort of brushed aside. And when you look at the law of previous referenda, you know, there are provisions and things kind of, you know, written into these things to make it legal or whatever. There was no such provision written into this referendum. And I know this has been sort of discussed, you know, at length by now, but, you know, this was described as an advisory thing. So, Andrew, like you said, I can understand how Theresa May probably needs to be really hard on a lot of these issues for the sake of her own party. But I think, you know, having the referendum in the first place was basically a political tool by David Cameron to keep his party together. And surely, you know, internal party politics, haven't we had enough of that when, you know, the chaos that's kind of ensuing from all this is just becoming so real? And you look at Mark Carney at the Bank of England saying, well, you know, food prices are going to start going up pretty soon. You know, people on the lowest wages, they're going to be really severely hit. And this is before even, you know, a single politician sat around the negotiating table. So I don't know. It's more questions than answers, really, or statements. But I just don't quite understand how, you know, say the millions of people who voted to leave, the millions of people who voted to stay, you know, how, why there isn't more of a kind of, you know, questioning of, well, we have Parliament and we have parliamentary processes, you know, the sort of darkest emotions, I guess, that were tapped into in the referendum campaign. Well, surely we need to put those in some sort of framework now, rather than just sort of, I don't know, the ideology of one political party.
Tom, final thought from you on this one. Do you get the impression that Britain is starting to understand what this is actually going to mean? What we've seen in the last few weeks, the pound heading towards the Earth's core at a rate of knots, the great Marmite crisis of this week, although I do feel it my patriotic duty to remind British listeners that Vegemite is still freely available and is a vastly superior yeast-based sandwich spread.
Three things. It's only a pale imitation. Secondly,
outside
that collapse,
now
that collapse
in the car park, the you and me, let's sort this out.
The collapse of Sterling, actually, I think, isn't helping in terms of making people realise what's happening, because it's serving as a buffer. All the pressure economically is being absorbed by Sterling's collapse, and that can't go on forever. But to your main point, are the British public finally realising what they voted for? Well, I don't think so yet. Everything else is going along nicely, partly because Sterling's taking the pressure. Heaven only knows how people are going to react if we do trigger Article 50, if this does actually happen, if we break these ties by 2018, perhaps 2019, it's going to be really, really bad. And people are going to be sorry. And of course, to go back to my earlier comment about turkeys and the festive season, the very people who voted most convincingly for this are almost certain to be those who feel the consequences most gravely.
And who are those people?
Well, everyone outside London, unfortunately, give or take, not in Scotland.
No, we may well have, which cues up our subject after the break quite nicely, because we may yet have another Scottish independence referendum to look forward to. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards, Daniel Jacopelli and Thomas Lewis. We will take a short break now. And coming up next, what happens when you ask the people to speak and you don't like what they say?
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, and Thomas Lewis. Now, back in 1966, the American political operative and prankster Dick Tuck, his real name, ran for the California Senate. Upon losing the election, he responded, "The people have spoken, the bastards." These sentiments have been echoed in several polities around the world this year, as voters in various elections, referenda, and party leadership contests have obstinately refused to line up as polls, political orthodoxy, and conventional wisdom suggested they should. Danny, with thinking about this, especially in terms of Colombia, which, much to its great surprise, put a peace deal ending more than half a century of war to the people, who said no thanks. What do you do when that happens? When clearly you're expecting that this vote could only possibly go one way, and I think that's what we saw happen here last year. No one really actually thought about what happens if everyone actually does vote yes, we want out.
I think there's 24 hours of shock, and then immediately they decide to just keep things as normal. I mean, in Colombia, they said, well, we're just going to go to Havana and keep negotiating. I mean, that's really what they've been doing for the past 4 years. They said they want to save the process. They probably will in some fashion. But I mean, you know, what happened here, 50% of the country more or less wanted it one way. The other 50 just have to kind of suck it up and get on with it. I mean, in Colombia, they say...
That's democracy, pretty much,
well, that's
defined
democracy.
Right there.
Or they just realized not to use referenda because they're a terrible tool.
Is there ever a cause, I guess, Tom Edwards, for just not necessarily ignoring, but sort of saying to the general public, all right, we hear you, we take your views on board, and we now propose to either ignore them or just adjust them slightly? And because it's not, especially in terms of EU referendum, it's not like there's no precedent for like holding referenda again and again until you get the right result. Ireland voted twice on the Treaty of Nice and Lisbon, Denmark twice on the Treaty of Maastricht. Should that option be kept open?
They're a little bit different because often the question was very slightly different. I prefer the Aussie model of a plebiscite where it's quite explicit from the get-go that we very well may choose to ignore what you say, but nevertheless, let your voice be heard. I admire how impressively sanguine Danny is about both FARC and the Brexit vote. But I think there's a lesson, and to sort of slightly paraphrase the quote from Dick Tuck that you began with, I think, was it, I mean, I won't quote this verbatim, of course, but Sid Vicious was asked about, you know, what he thought the man in the street made of his various exploits, and he said, "Oh, I've met the man in the street, and he's
indeed
fill in the blanks for yourself." I think the lesson is, don't ask the people. Some things are too important. Now, some people might say, well, look, that's completely contrary to the very principles of participatory democracy. But I would say, well, look at the evidence. Look at that FARC deal. Look at the Brexit vote. I cannot believe any right-minded person would say anything other than that both those things are deeply, deeply regrettable and hugely potentially damaging.
It would have
been better had the people not been asked. I cannot get away from that fundamental position.
There should have been maybe an automatic follow-up referendum triggered, which just...
Are you sure?
Well, exactly, which just puts the question on the ballot, seriously, are you insane?
Well, no, but look, we've known this for decades. The powerful argument against this kind of participatory democracy, certainly in this country, Andrew, when I was like studying politics when I was younger, was, well, of course, if you ask the people, they'd bring back capital punishment.
Sure.
All these things which are true, probably more enthusiastically now than ever before. You know, if you don't want to risk it, don't ask the question.
The point of government is to kind of temper the animal instincts of the population who are kind of vengeful, passionate, instinctual. I mean, the point of a politician is to say, okay, I hear your point of view, let me kind of see how we can make that work from a
and
policy perspective.
And democracy's more refined.
I believe in direct democracy too, but
let people have their say in the general election. If they don't like what you've done as an administration, they can kick you out. That's the principle.
For instance, in the US, most people want more government spending on roads, on bridges, on the government, on education, but they also want low taxes. Of course, those two things are incompatible. But if you do a referendum, you know, they'll vote for both of those things in. And you can't govern in that sense. I mean, it's kind of a fun thing to do, but sometimes it works.
I mean, final thought on this one, Tom Edwards. Do you think we're likely to see referenda declining in popularity around the world following this year's experiences?
I think it looks likely. Though I think, going right back, even something that Thomas said about Cameron introducing this to try and, you know, appease one wing of his party. Don't forget, in this country, you know, the Tories wrote this into their manifesto as the first thing to kick out of said manifesto in the next coalition talks.
Well,
this was
obviously
never meant to be
a key
tranche. They never thought they'd win, and it was only Labour's ineptitude which enabled the Tories to win an outright majority. It's still Labour's ineptitude now, principally, which means that Tories feel they're living in this consequence-free environment. So, you know, there's a lot of things to fix in British politics, and I hope that referendums is one of them.
Well, we are going to close tonight on another example of direct democracy having a somewhat surprising result, though with possibly less grave or consequential consequences, if you will. And that is a poll conducted by Scotland's National Tourism Board, which has decided that the country's most admired man-made structure is the Forth Bridge, the venerable span linking North and South Queensferry. While undeniably beautiful, it is perhaps a surprise winner, tipping out Edinburgh Castle, which prompts the question, what is your underrated architectural marvel? Thomas, in Toronto first, is there a particular Torontonian or Canadian building that you've particularly come to admire during your time there?
There are a few, actually, and I just say that I went to university in Scotland and used to use the Forth Rail Bridge quite a lot, and it is the most, I think it is a really magnificent thing, and I think it's a lovely, lovely sort of, you know, testament really that the Scottish public, you know, this big sort of, you know, piece of industrial architecture has such a sort of romantic place, like for so many of them. I think it's really sort of lovely. But yes, in Toronto, we've just finished up the Toronto Travel Guide, actually, so it's been quite a nice opportunity to sort of dig around Toronto's kind of architectural gems. I think mine would be Honest Ed's. So Honest Ed's is this huge discount store. No, it's this huge discount store, and it looks like it's very famous for its big sort of glittery sort of casino-esque kind of signs outside with these very cheesy dated kind of slogans outside, you know, about sort of cheap prices and this kind of stuff. Really sort of this landmark of a sort of bygone time. And you go inside this place and it's, you know, very sort of ordinary, really. You can buy a lasagna dish or, you know, get your clothes tailored. It's sort of an amazing place. And you've got these posters all around the outside with sort of Liberace signing to Ed, you know, Mervish, who founded this thing sort of decades ago, you know, love your store and this kind of thing. It's a place like I've never really sort of seen before. And, you know, they are actually knocking it down at the end of this year. And when that was announced a couple of years ago, you know, it really sort of caused quite a lot of outrage, I think, in Toronto, that this kind of kooky sort of landmark that had been part of life for so long, kind of in this corner of the city, would sort of be no more. But, you know, I think people have come to terms with it, and you know, we'll sort of remember it, you know,
okay,
pretty,
well,
in a pretty treasured way.
While Thomas Lewis chains himself to the railings at Honest Ed's, Danny, what's your particular favourite?
Well, when I was a child, I did a lot of road trips across the country with my parents in my family van, a blue Dodge Caravan. And among, you know, the U.S. has a lot of wacky roadside attractions, as you probably know. One of which is the Corn Palace in South Dakota. It's in Mitchell, South Dakota, and it's literally...
I've been to Waldrug in South Dakota, which is
amazing.
I've been
there too. I've been there as well. The Corn Palace is... It kind of looks like the Kremlin. It has, like, those weird kind of... I don't know, Russian turret-like things, but it's all made out of corn. So it's this giant building made out of corn. That's number one. Number two...
Oh, you got a selection. This is good.
Great. Number two is the Cabazon Dinosaurs in California, which I went to on a road trip a couple years ago across California. These are these large, really large dinosaurs made by some crazy man, and it's attached to a creationist museum where you can see, like, humans walking amongst dinosaurs. Absolutely brilliant. And that's all I got. I was gonna say the opposite of one is Penn Station in New York, which is like, you know, the second level of purgatory. But that's all I got.
Tom.
Well, I think what's interesting about the Forth Bridge is if we look at that sort of William Morris definition of what makes something beautiful, it's very functionality. And this is something which has proven its longevity in functional terms since, what, the late 19th century, I think, when it was first built.
This is pretty boring, Tom.
Well, no. And so my one would be the same. It's something that history, I think, judges more kindly than the critical reception of the time. And that's London South Bank, the National Theatre, or other monuments by the brutalist architect Sir Denis Lasdon. Vilified upon their construction, but I think absolutely sensational. UEA campus in East Anglia is one, but I think the South Bank for me is just a perfect part of London, and an incredible, I think, monument to humans' kind of clarity of vision for purpose for buildings.
Andrew, I hope you have a wackier one to end yours.
Well, mine would actually be a synthesis, if you will, of both of the ones that, you know, that Tom and Danny have espoused. It's a road trip thing. And again, as you say, Tom, they are functional and they are beautiful. These are the big things of Australia.
Ah.
The roadside attractions built by otherwise obscure country settlements, so people will actually stop there for some reason.
You've got to pick a single favourite.
Adrian Connick did a piece on in the magazine.
Indeed he did. My particular favourite is the giant trout of Adaminaby.
Oh, great. I should have said in Minnesota there's Paul Bunyan, I think. He has a big statue. He's
probably.
Anyway.
It's not as good. It's no giant trout, though, is it?
It's no giant trout. And on that bombshell, Tom Edwards, Thomas Lewis and Daniel Giacopelli, thank you for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra, our studio manager, Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900. Marcus is in with the menu. I've got more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.